This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Many parts of Australia, the cost of buying a home or renting one has gone through the roof since the start of the pandemic. One economist is predicting that prices could keep on rising once Australia reopens its borders to migrants. Nassim Kadam reports.
Like most migrants who come to Australia, Poonima Balasubramanian now feels lucky to call it home.
I am constantly preaching to my family and to my friends to move to Australia.
Now living in Melbourne after moving from Singapore with her husband and daughter almost 4 years ago, she's working as a kindergarten teacher and is in the final stages of becoming a permanent resident. But buying a family home is proving tricky.
I'm finding the process frustrating and I'm so close to just quitting, but I know I've got to find some sort of solution because we just can't look at renting for the rest of our lives.
In Sydney's hot housing market, former migrant, now Australian citizen Sid Lal has looked at hundreds of properties, but he's also struggling to find one.
We are having to extend our budget significantly because, what was available a year ago at the price point has now gone up by, I would say, easy 20%.
Sid Lal has rented for 4 years and he's worried he'll soon have more competition as he tries to buy his own property.
We're very aware of the fact that migration is going to open back up. And once that opens up with a new wave of migrants coming in, there's going to be a new wave of money and property prices are probably going to increase even further.
And that's because migrant numbers may continue to rise well above budget predictions because of the demand to fill skill shortages in the post-COVID economic recovery.
If immigration were to come back rapidly, we would see significant upward pressure on rents and significant upwards pressure on house prices.
Shane Oliver is the chief economist at AMP Capital. He's predicting house prices could rise by 5% and rents could increase by 7% if the annual migrant intake reaches above 250,000 by 2023.
To solve this problem of poor affordability, we need more supply. Yes, supply has kept up with demand over the last few years, but that was after a decade or so of undersupply relative to demand.
The solution could be building more homes, especially in inner city areas where people want to live, as well as encouraging Australians to move to regional areas. The Urban Task Force, which represents property developers, supports calls by some politicians for a higher migrant intake. Its chief executive is Tom Forrest.
But government's got to chew gum and skip rope. They've got to both return immigration but also have their planning systems deliver more planning approvals to allow the private sector to go and deliver more houses so we don't get a rapid escalation in housing prices and rental prices going forward.
That's Tom Forrest from the Urban Task Force, ending that report from Nassim Kadam. You might not want to face it, but the countdown to a federal election is well and truly underway. The Prime Minister spent the past couple of days claiming that petrol prices and interest rates would rise under Labor. This morning, the opposition leader Anthony Albanese is promising to connect more Australians to high-speed internet if he becomes the PM. We spoke a short time ago. Anthony Albanese, thanks for talking to AM. In a nutshell, you're promising 1.5 million homes will have their copper connection upgraded to fibre if they want it by 2025. Why do you think this is a vote winner?
Well, because one of the things that people have recognised during COVID is that fibre is better than copper, that people need high-speed broadband in order for students to study, in order for businesses to operate, in order for people to work from home. And the fact is that people were gutted when this government trashed the NBN model to move to a mix of fibre and copper. And depending upon luck of the draw, some people have access to 21st century technology, but too many households don't.
Labor's original promise more than a decade ago was 93% of homes on fibre. Will this upgrade bring it to that?
This will bring it to 90%, and we know that we have a big technological repair job as the result of the negative policies of this government, who, when they came to office, of course, said that high-speed fibre was a waste. They thought it was all about downloading videos. We know that it's not. We know that it's about healthcare, it's about education services, it's about businesses being able to operate in the 21st century.
you're promising not to privatise the NBN. Is that a never-ever promise, or is that just until this upgrade's finished?
No, but it's until it's appropriate for full consideration to be given. That is, it's in the public interest for access to NBN to be publicly owned, to make sure that we don't have more divides between haves and have-nots. And if you privatise the services, we don't want to see what happened with Telstra, which was a privatisation that led to monopoly power, a privatisation that required Labor as part of our NBN policy to introduce the structural separation that was necessary to introduce competition into the sector.
Now, Australia's about 59th in the world for broadband speed currently. What ranking do you want to see it by the end of a first-term Albanese government?
I want Australia to be as high as we can be. We are ranked 59th in the world. This government have purchased 60,000 kilometres of copper wire, enough to go around the earth 1.5 times. It's absurd in the 21st century.
Where do you want to see Australia by the end of a first term? Top 10, top 20?
I want Australia to certainly be where we should be, which is we are a G20 nation and we should be in the top 20 in the world. I want to see Australia perform at our best. It requires bringing Australia into the 21st century, not being scared of the present and terrified of the future, which is something that defines this government.
Now, to deliver this policy, you have to win government. The coalition signalling a cost of living campaign, asserting only it can be trusted. If you become Prime Minister, how will you keep a lid on record low inflation and interest rates amid rising petrol and housing prices?
Well, overnight, the Reserve Bank Governor has said himself that interest rates won't increase in 2022. The Reserve Bank set interest rates, not the government. When it comes to petrol prices, Scott Morrison hasn't filled up for a long period of time because petrol is rising under his watch. It's up to $1.80 at my local petrol station. And this is an example of whereby the Prime Minister is running a scare campaign, just making things up at a time when his own projections are that real wages won't keep up with inflation. And that's after record low real wages on his watch since this government was elected in 2013.
Okay, on those two points, what would you do to keep petrol down and boosting the wages of the vulnerable? Are you offering direct government intervention?
What we're offering is to fix the Fair Work Act so that secure employment becomes an objective of the Act, properly defining casualisation, making sure that we make that people like gig workers get at least the minimum wage and including them in the employment system. When it comes to petrol prices, this requires the ACCC to act. The government needs to explain why it is that petrol prices are increasing on its watch. This is a government whose idea of fuel security was to establish fuel reserves in the Gulf of Mexico, nowhere near Australia.
Mr Albanese, your offsider Jim Chalmers is calling Mr Morrison the liar from the Shire. At a time when people are so jaded with politics, how wise is it to make it that personal?
Well, the fact is that what is not wise is having a leader who just makes things up and who denies his own words. And we have in Scott Morrison someone who himself says, don't worry about what I said yesterday, because today I'll have something different to say and pretend it wasn't said. Whether it comes to electric vehicles, whether it comes to the sort of nonsense scare campaigns that we're already seeing being run out. This is a Prime Minister who has presided over a real decline in integrity. This is a Prime Minister who hasn't been prepared to have serious policy debates, whether it be on the floor of Parliament or in public. This is a Prime Minister who simply isn't up to taking Australia forward into the future.
Mr Albanese, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks very much, Sabra.
Federal Labor leader Anthony Albanese. Well, working from home during the pandemic has had some big benefits, which might be hard to hand back when we finally return to the office. But have you noticed it's also been easier to do extra pieces of work at home when you might normally have clocked off? A report out this morning says average Australians worked an additional 6 hours a week during the pandemic, all of it unpaid, translating into 8 unpaid working weeks a year. Here's our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
An hour here, an hour there, just to get the job done. The Home Office has never been so productive. The Australia Institute Centre for Future Work surveyed 1,600 workers over 3 days in August at the height of major lockdowns in Sydney and Melbourne and found an average 6 hours of unpaid or unclaimed overtime per week, equating to 319 hours a year. That adds up to a potential 8 weeks for the average worker.
I don't like to think that employers are using working from home arrangements as a way of further exploiting workers. But at the same time, a lot of workers are talking about the need to complete their work outside of work hours.
Economist Dan Nahum has been researching unpaid work during the pandemic, and he says the stolen overtime represents $125 billion erased from household budgets over the year, a problem he thinks is systemic.
We think it's been institutionalised the whole time. And unfortunately, what we're seeing through COVID is that employer demands are increasing. The move towards working from home is probably blurring some of those boundaries between work life and home life. And we're worried that workers don't have the protections that they need from exploitation, such as a right to disconnect from work outside of working hours.
But surely employers must have some sort of responsibility for this, or are some employers turning a blind eye to this, making the most of the additional work that they don't have to pay for?
Yeah, in a labour market like this, where it's not necessarily clear that people will be able to quit and get a better job or a job that better respects their work-life balance, I think people just do what they need to do to get the job done.
Not surprisingly, it's a mixed picture for employers who've been managing staff working from home. But Innes Willocks, chief executive of the Australian Industry Group, says workplaces will need to adapt to the new needs of employees who want their flexible lifestyles recognised.
There's no doubt that a lot of people have really grown to enjoy working from home, but some employers are saying that they've really noticed big downturns in productivity from people working at home. You know, we're going to take a little while to work through this, and there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all solution. But employers know that at a time of great labour and skill shortages, they have to provide as much flexibility as they can to be employers of choice.
The revelations of unpaid work during the pandemic add to wider underpayment scandals where major listed companies and government agencies have been outed by the Fair Work Ombudsman for systemic breaches that in some cases amount to wages theft.
Peter Ryan reporting there. US journalist Danny Fenster has been reunited with his family in America just days after he was released from jail in Myanmar. He was given a lengthy sentence last week after being convicted for spreading false information. He'd already been in prison for 6 months. Supporters of Sean Turnell, the Australian economist detained in the conflict-torn nation after the February coup, are buoyed by Fenster's release. Southeast Asia correspondent Mazoe Ford reports.
After 176 days in a Myanmar jail, journalist Danny Fenster was overjoyed to be reunited with his family in New York.
How's it feel to be back?
Feels incredible.
Just 3 days earlier, the magazine editor was facing a very different fate. A military court sentenced him to 11 years jail for incitement and breaches of immigration and unlawful assembly laws. But former US ambassador to the UN, Bill Richardson, negotiated with the junta for his release. Peter Grester from the Alliance for Journalists' Freedom says it's a great result for Mr. Fenster, but points to a bigger problem.
There are literally dozens and dozens of other journalists inside Myanmar who are still in prison, who don't have the support of a foreign government to advocate for them and to help negotiate their release, and who are languishing in prison simply for doing their jobs.
Sophie McNeil from Human Rights Watch says thousands of political prisoners are behind bars too.
So Danny's the story we hear about, but there's more than 10,000 people who've been arrested since the coup. And Human Rights Watch has verified that, you know, people have been tortured there, including being tortured to death.
Others are on trial in closed courts, such as Australian economist Sean Turnell, who was advising Ms. Suu Kyi's government before the coup. He's facing up to 14 years jail if found guilty of violating the Official Secrets Act. But friend Tim Harcourt says the deportation of Danny Fenster offers hope.
Well, it's extraordinary, isn't it? It just shows that all these things are up for negotiation.
He says because Australia's efforts to negotiate the release of Professor Turnell have so far failed, it might be time to change tack.
The US is very good at getting its citizens out of difficult places using their, you know, their former senior statesmen and women. And I don't see why you wouldn't. We have a lot of ex-prime ministers at the moment making a lot of noise in the press. Why not have them do something useful?
Journalist Peter Grester, who spent more than a year in an Egyptian prison, believes Australia's quiet diplomacy towards Myanmar since the coup isn't working.
Look, I think we need to get noisy. I think that the military junta in Myanmar are sensitive to public opinion. I think they're conscious of the way that the rest of the world sees and understands them. They've got pretty thick skins, but I still think that that kind of noise does have an effect. We also need to, as a country, need to apply considerable diplomatic pressure.
The Australian government has repeatedly asked the junta to release Sean Turnell and all those unjustly detained. It's also severed military ties and redirected aid money, but has not gone as far as the US, UK and EU by imposing sanctions.
That's our Southeast Asia correspondent, Mazoe Ford. Ugly displays of racism from crowds have sometimes marred major sporting events in Australia, but now new guidelines have been issued to help sporting codes and venues respond to inappropriate behaviour when it happens. Nick Grimm reports.
Australians love their sport and take plenty of pride in the nation's on-field triumphs. But a bit too often, some of those barracking at the sidelines are themselves a national embarrassment.
Today, once again, our players have been racially abused.
In January this year, India's visiting cricket team accused Australian spectators at the SCG of hurling racist slurs, prompting apologies from Cricket Australia and this from head coach Justin Langer.
I've said for years, it's one of my greatest pet hates in life that people can think they can come to a sporting event, whether it's cricket or any code, and pay their money and think they can abuse or say whatever they like.
It's fairly simple. We all love sports. But unfortunately, racism in sport remains an ongoing issue.
Australia's Race Discrimination Commissioner, Chin Tan, was watching the match as the controversy unfolded. Now he's launching new guidelines for Australia's major sporting codes on how to address racism from spectators.
And so while sport matters because people watch it, learn from it, and they're inspired by it, we need consistent, strong responses to spectator racism, which we have seen the last year or so.
But the victory was overshadowed by an alleged racist taunt involving goods in the dying minutes.
The new guidelines are part of an ongoing Human Rights Commission campaign championed by former AFL star and Australian of the Year Adam Goods, who endured relentless racial slurs from rival fans.
Racism! Racism! It stops with me!
It stops with me.
But for others, this is still just the start of the journey. Under the new guidelines, a zero-tolerance approach will see the immediate removal of those behaving inappropriately, and some fans could be banned from attending games until they've undergone anti-racism training. Cricket Australia, the AFL, the NRL and Tennis Australia have endorsed the guidelines, also agreeing to adopt a coordinated approach when it comes to ensuring incidents are properly reported, complaints appropriately addressed, and the targets of racist abuse given the opportunity to speak about their experience.
We know that racism exists and we know that it's not always going to be hidden.
Tanya Hosh is the AFL's Executive General Manager for Inclusion and Social Policy. She believes that with the major codes showing a united front, attitudes will eventually shift.
The more safe we make the sporting arena, the more people can participate in something that is a really healthy social activity.
Tanya Hosh is the AFL's Executive General Manager for Inclusion and Social Policy. Nick Grimm reporting there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
You don't see gallows at a protest all that often in Australia, but they've appeared more than once in the past week in Melbourne. The scenes are just the most visible part of the backlash to the Victorian government's new pandemic plan, which has been described as an attack on democracy by the state opposition. So, what is it about this bill that's inspired so much anger?
Today on The Signal, why Victoria's Pandemic Powers Bill is grabbing national headlines. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.